Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This edition of Radio Curious is dedicated to the memory of Howard Zinn. In a few minutes, we'll play the interview I did with him in 2006. But before that, I'd like to share some memories that I have about Howard Zinn. I'd like to begin by reading a section of The People's History of the United States. At the end of the first chapter entitled Columbus, the Indians, and Human Progress, he concludes by saying in part, "So Columbus and his successors were not coming into an empty wilderness, but into a world in which some places was as densely populated as Europe itself, where the culture was complex, where human relations were more egalitarian than in Europe, and where the relations among men, women, and children and nature were more beautifully worked out than perhaps any place in the world. They were a people without a written language, but with their own laws, their poetry, their history, kept in memory and passed on in an oral vocabulary more complex than Europe's, accompanied by song, dance, and ceremonial drama. They paid careful attention to the development of personality, intensity of will, independence and flexibility, passion and potency, to their partnership with one another and with nature." John Collier, an American scholar who lived among the Indians in the 1920s and the 1930s in the American Southwest, said of their spirit, "Could we make it our own, there would be an eternally inexhaustible earth and forever lasting peace." Howard Zinn went on to write, "Perhaps there was some romantic mythology in that. But the evidence from European travelers in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, put together by an American specialist on Indian life, William Brandon, is overwhelmingly supportive of much of that myth. Even allowing for the imperfection of myths, it is enough to make us question, from that time and ours, the excuse of progress in the annihilation of races, and the telling of history from the standpoint of the conquerors and leaders of Western civilization." I first met Howard Zinn at the Freedom House, organized and operated by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Greenwood, Mississippi, in the middle of August of 1963. He was 41 years old. I was 20 years old. He had just finished his teaching job, having been expelled from a teaching position at Spelman College. I spent that summer traveling around the United States, spending significant time in Mississippi and Alabama. Although I can't remember what he and I talked about those weeks that we were in Greenwood, I do remember the sense of here's a special person. The memories of our time together, brief as it was, working on voter registration with SNCC in Greenwood, Mississippi that summer, have stayed with me since that moment. And they were revitalized again in 1988 and 1989 when I began to read The People's History of the United States. In 2006, The Essential Zinn was published, and I had the good fortune of having a phone interview with Howard Zinn that summer. It hasn't been broadcast before, and I'd like to share it with you now. This interview with Howard Zinn was recorded on July 7th, 2006. Howard Zinn, welcome to Radio Curious.
Oh, thank you, Barry Vogel.
In looking at your book, Original Zinn, and examining your experience in the United States, watching it and watching the world, what would be your prediction for the place of the United States 20 years in our future, 2026?
It's interesting to ask historians for predictions. It's a very dangerous thing because historians really don't know anything about the future. they know about the past, and so they guess like everybody else about the future.
Well, there is some thought that history repeats itself. That's certainly a Native American position.
It's history repeats itself, and yet there are new things that are always happening in history. So, you know, history is a mixture of the old and the new. So what will the United States be like, you know, 20 years from now? It depends. You know, John Dewey, when he was asked to predict, said, people think that you should predict so that you will know what to do. He said, I think you should do so that you will know what to predict. In other words, what happens 20 years from now depends on what we do. If we do not create a new social movement in this country that provides an obstacle to the policies that are now going on, to the policies of war and the taking of the nation's wealth for militarism and for the super rich, if we do not create a new social movement that stops the direction in which we are now going, then 20 years from now, we are going to be in terrible shape. We will be in continual crisis. We will be an impoverished nation while sitting on the richest pile of wealth, you might say, in the world. And we will be a controlled nation. That is, we will be a nation which, extrapolating from what is happening with the Bush administration, a nation in which the president wields total power and spies on everybody in order to control their ideas. That's the worst scenario. The best scenario is if we manage in these next 2 years to create a new social movement, a movement that combines the energy of all those movements of the 60s, of the civil rights movement, of the anti-war movement, of the women's movement, of the gay and lesbian movement, disabled persons movement, of the labor movement, a movement that combines all the energies of the people who are left out of, you know, the privilege of the super rich. If we can create such a movement, then 20 years from now, we will have a country that doesn't have military bases all over the world, that doesn't invade other countries, that doesn't have a military budget to speak of, and therefore that has hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of wealth in order to create free health care for everybody without the intervention of insurance companies and without profiteering.
Who would be starting that new social movement? Where would the impetus come from?
You and I are going to do it right now on this program. Now, well, who is going to be starting it? I don't know.
Usually it's the people who are suffering in the groups that you mention, the civil rights movement, before that the union movement, the women's movement. They were people who felt oppressed. But now when our country is at war, it looks pretty much like business as usual for most people.
Well, it's business as usual, and yet 65% of the population or so want us to get out of Iraq. It's business as usual, and yet roughly the same number of people no longer have any confidence in the Bush administration, which means that there are huge numbers of people who, even though they are going about their business, do not like what is happening now. So there's a huge reservoir, I believe, of goodwill and common sense to draw upon. And the problem is not a population that is really not thinking. The problem is how to take the huge number of people in this country who really want universal and free health care, who really don't want us to be at war, take that huge number of people and organize them, mobilize them.
And what is your answer to that? How do we take that?
Well, how do we organize them? How do we mobilize them? Well, in the way that has been done historically by, you know, you mentioned the labor movement, and we have the experience of the movements of the 60s, by education, by acts of dramatic importance that bring people around. I mean, how does an anti-war movement grow, for instance? Hundreds of people are gathering in Washington, D.C., who are fasting in protest against the war. More and more people will take notice of that. There are vigils against the war going on all over the country, in hundreds of towns all over the country. Movements start small, and they grow if they make sense and appeal to the rest of the population. That's why we're able to build a movement in the South, which was powerful enough to change the South, get rid of official racial segregation in the South. So, you know, there's no easy answer to it. It's a long, persistent struggle of bringing people together around common interests.
When people are brought together by oppression, and the common interest is releasing that yoke of oppression.
Take the issue, as I say, of oppression. When black people rebelled in the South in the 1950s and 1960s, it was not because they were more oppressed at that time than they had been 10 or 20 years earlier. It's that there had been a growing, and a gradual, yes, incremental growing of resentment against an oppression that had existed a long time. And so, sure, the American people may not be oppressed in this intense way that slaves were oppressed, or people working 16 hours a day were oppressed, but the American people are oppressed in the sense that they're taxes are being used for purposes that don't serve human needs. They're being oppressed in that they are living in a healthcare system which is far, far too expensive and which, you know, leads to all sorts of problems for people. They're oppressed in a way that they're insecure economically. Even if they're professionals, they don't know where their jobs are going to be next week. And if they're not professionals, if they're down at the lower, you know, one-fifth of the population, they probably need to work two jobs to survive. So there is oppression going on. Of course, they're oppressed if their kids have to go off to war and come back without a leg or an arm or blinded. That's an oppression. And it's an oppression which, you know, may not manifest itself immediately and dramatically, but where people may gradually have their indignation and anger grow and finally react against it, as black people did in the South, and as the people in this country did when the oppression of the Vietnam War, which only grew gradually as the bodies came home and the recognition of what we were doing in Vietnam became clear, a point was reached where the movement turned at a certain apex and became powerful enough so that the government had to pay attention to it.
Let's talk about civil disobedience and how that can be used as a tool for social change. And we know that beginning with the Boston Tea Party, that was one of the early acts of civil disobedience. And in fact, the United States was founded on a war of civil disobedience. How do you see that now in the 21st century, the use of civil disobedience as a tool for social change?
Well, I mean, you're right to go back to history and to talk about the Boston Tea Party, because if you trace civil disobedience up through American history, you see that it has always been necessary in order to rectify injustices. The anti-slavery people in the 1850s had to violate the Fugitive Slave Act, had to break into police stations and courtrooms to rescue slaves. People in the labor movement had to violate laws that outlawed strikes in order to go on strike. The people who sat in the General Motors plants in Flint, Michigan, in the 1930s were committing acts of civil disobedience. They were violating the property rights by sitting. And of course, we know about the civil disobedience of the SNCC and King and the Southern people in the movement in the 60s and the civil disobedience against the war. And the reason civil disobedience remains an important tool, and in fact is being done today, although, you know, a lot of it is not publicized because the mainstream press won't give it any attention. But the reason civil disobedience is always necessary is because the normal institutions of government are not sufficient to correct the great injustices that exist. I mean, the normal institutions of government, that is Congress, the President, the Supreme Court, have never been adequate to deal with the problems that we have in this country, and that's why movements have had to take place of citizens. That's why civil disobedience, acting outside the law, breaking laws, that's why all of that has been necessary in order to mobilize people, bring the realities to their attention. I mean, just it is going on today. I mean, the people who trespass on military territory and get arrested, so-called St. Patrick's Five, who are now serving time in jail because they sort of poured their own blood on Marine recruiting station. You know, the grannies who were arrested because they also committed civil disobedience at a recruiting station. Well, the GIs who are refusing to go, came back from Iraq and are refusing to go back, all those people are committing civil disobedience, and it's those acts of civil disobedience which build up and build up, which dramatize what is going on, and which help build a movement.
This edition of Radio Curious is presented in memory to Howard Zinn, who died in January of 2010. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Before we continue with the 2006 conversation with Howard Zinn, I'd like to play a song called "Ain't Gonna Let Segregation Turn Us Around," sung by the Freedom Singers in 1962 from the Broadside Record, Volume 1.
Ain't gonna let nobody, nobody turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody, nobody turn me round. Keep on a walking, nobody, keep on a talking, nobody, marching up the freedom lane.
Ain't gonna let segregation, nobody
turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let segregation, nobody turn me round, keep on a walking, yeah, keep on a talking, yeah, marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let no jailhouse, Lord,
turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let no jailhouse turn me round, keep on a walking, Lord, keep on a talking, Lord, marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let no nervous Nelly, Lord,
turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nervous Nelly, Lordy, turn me round. Keep on a walking, yeah, yeah, keep on a talking, yeah, marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let Chief Petty, Lordy,
turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let Chief Petty, Lordy, turn me round, keep on a walking, Lord, keep on a talking, Lord, marching up to freedom lane.
Ain't gonna let Mayor Kelly, Lord,
turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let Mayor Kelly, Lord, turn me round, keep on a walking, Lord, keep on a talking, Lord, marching up to freedom lane.
Ain't gonna let no Uncle Thumber, Lordy,
turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let no Uncle Thumber, Lordy, turn me round, keep on a walking, yeah, yeah, keep on a talking, yeah, yeah, marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let nobody, Lordy,
turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody, Lordy, turn
me loud, I'm gonna keep on a walking, yeah. Keep on a talking, yeah. I'm marching up the freedom land.
Howard Zinn, let's talk about SNCC.
Yes.
You and I were present in Greenwood, Mississippi in July and August of 1963.
I remember being in Greenwood in August of 1963, and my wife was with me at the time, and you know, it was an interesting time, yes.
Shortly before then, your teaching position at Spelman College was terminated. What are your perspectives then and now about the desegregation movement and your work with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee?
Well, you know, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you know, as you know, was really the leading edge of the civil rights movement. You know, young people who went into the most dangerous areas of the South and set up freedom houses and worked with the local people and I mean, what they did was they brought democracy alive because they understood that you had to go outside the major institutions and you had to organize people and then take risks and even go to jail and get beaten sometimes in order to bring about social change. That was a very, very important moment in our history, one of the most admirable moments in our history. The civil rights movement, which succeeded in doing so much in changing the South, but did not do enough, left for another time, another generation, maybe this generation or the next generation, the even more difficult job, more difficult than changing the laws on racial segregation, and that is economic justice. The problem of black people, like the problem of white people, fundamentally is a problem of economics, the distribution of wealth, for the fact you can do away with signs of black and white and segregation, but if most black people are poor and live in terrible parts of the city and their kids are desperate and end up in jail or end up in the military, that is the fundamental problem that remains. So the civil rights movement and SNCC and the other groups did something important, but they left untouched, or certainly not solved. And King, Martin Luther King, knew this, and that's why he turned to economic issues just before he died. They left untouched the question of the economic system, of capitalism and socialism, and King was very, very acutely aware of the fact that militarism and war and capitalism were intertwined, and you had to do something to change the way the economic system worked in order to bring about economic justice. That was fundamental. So that remains today as the legacy of those years in the South that you participated in also.
Now we have perhaps even a greater problem with the corporate dominance of our country. Very few people work for themselves as individuals. Most work for a business, a large corporation, or a government entity, which seems to me that if you're saying the problem of economics and the problem of capitalism was a problem then, isn't it much more exacerbated now?
It is. It, absolutely. It's worse now. Corporate control is more overbearing now. Concentration of wealth is greater now than it ever has been. And furthermore, we have a government in power that serves the interests of corporate wealth. And I must say that even though, you know, we have a Democratic Party, which presumably is different, it's not different enough because the Democratic Party historically has also served the interests of the wealthy classes. And so we have a problem of organizing people in this country to really diminish corporate control of our lives. And this requires a much stronger labor movement. It requires a movement of consumers. It requires democratizing the economy, because we always think about political democracy and voting and so on, but what we most need is economic democracy in which corporations don't determine how many hours we work and or how many jobs we have to work to keep alive, and in which people can play a part in determining how they live.
Well, Howard Zinn, let me ask you this. Looking at the young people now who are students in the universities where you teach and work, how do you see them as an activist or an less than activist group of people than previous generations?
Well, obviously students today are not doing as much as they were doing in the height of the 1960s, both the civil rights and the anti-war movement. But I believe that fundamentally young people are idealistic. Young people want to do something good. And if they have an opportunity, they will act. If they begin to see that something is wrong, that they can do something about, they will. I mean, after all, the generation of social activists among students in the 1960s was just a few years after the generation of the 50s. The same people who were looked upon as quiet and subservient in the 1950s suddenly became aroused in the 1960s. In other words, all young people have the capacity to become involved and active, and I believe that's true of this generation too. And many of them are, but it's a developmental process which grows and grows, and I think the potential is there.
Before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, Anthony Arnov, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, is a book that tells you about the situation in Iraq today. Also, there is the book by Stephen Kinzer called Overthrow, which is a history of the United States attempts and very often successful attempts at regime change over the last 100 years, which have turned out to be disastrous. These are, I think, good and useful books.
Well, Howard Zinn, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Sure.
In this edition of Radio Curious, dedicated to the memory of Howard Zinn, we've been listening to a 2006 interview that I recorded with him soon after a book called The Essential Zinn was published. The books that Howard Zinn recommends are Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal by Anthony Arnov, A-R-N-O-V, and Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq by Stephen Kinzer, K-I-N-Z-E-R. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You can also subscribe to the Radio Curious podcast by clicking on our website. Our programs are also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website, radiocurious.org, for further details. And we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and do enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone number is 707-462-6541. Our programs are recorded in our studios in Ukiah, California. Hannah Bird heads our post-production staff. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.